For he's always glad when everything's bad, cause then his collections are good, 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 good. His nose knows no pathway of roses, no flowers that bloom in the spring. For it's catch as catch can for the scavenger man. Posterity, where is thy... All right, we're done.
That was so good, man.
Hey there, this is Seth Waters from Channel 9. We're here at Dev Intersection in Las Vegas with Elijah Manor. How you doing, buddy?
Hey. Doing well. It's good to be here.
Good. What kind of stuff do you work on?
Lately, I've been working on a single-page app using React, ES6. We use Sass, mm-hmm. and just a lot of cool tools. Sometimes it's bleeding edge, but it's really a joy. Enjoy doing that.
That's awesome. So I've heard a lot about React from some pretty smart people, and their take is React is really cool. Can you tell us why you think it's important to know React, to know about it?
Yeah, there's several reasons why I really like it personally. One, I think for me in particular, it's really fast. That's number one. But that shouldn't be a reason to necessarily go to something.
Sure.
I think the biggest reason for me is it really simplifies the problem space a developer works on. Mm-hmm. So for example, their components, and that's kind of a buzzword in most frameworks these days.
Yeah.
But React really tries to focus in on props are coming in, like properties. You shouldn't ever change them. And there should be some result. And so if you simplify it really easy like that, it's super easy to unit test, like because you know the things that are coming in and you know the output. And so it makes it very easy to get your head around. Now, there's something called state as well. So if a component actually is changing, you could tell it to update its state and things could change. What you typically want to do, the further you get down in your component layer, like the more you compose them, you want the inner layer components to be very stupid.
Uh-huh.
Like there's no state. You just pass in something and there's the end result. Higher up, things the state will change and it'll just propagate all the props down.
I see.
Everything kind of works.
And so there, and I remember seeing a little bit of React. The thing that was interesting to React is it had this sort of burnt-in HTML.
They call it JSX.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have it rubs them the wrong way.
And I either way, I think it's great that you're able to do a syntax check, so to speak, on the HTML. But what you're saying is that there's this notion of state. Mm-hmm. And then all the components can subscribe to changes in that state.
Yeah, typically you'll have a controller component that's a higher level, and it will listen to changes in a store, like a place where information is stored.
Mm-hmm.
And if the store ever changes, it'll emit like, hey, I've changed. And the controller component is like, oh, I need to know that data. And then it passes, updates the state and passes it down as props to all its children.
I see.
Everything just sort of refreshes.
I see. So here's a question. It seems like, is it organized in the same way that an MVC star type application in Angular is going to be organized? Because it seems like you have a controller, but in the controller there's maybe tons of little tiny components or bigger to smaller components that are in there.
It's quite different. They call the architecture Flux. Anyway, there's actions that whatever you're actually interacting with on the web page, that would be probably a lower level component.
Mm-hmm.
If you click on something, that would trigger an action. And then the action would get distributed. The stores would listen to those actions and decide if they need to respond. They would update their state or mm-hmm. their store.
Mm-hmm.
And then the controller components listen to that. And just the cycle is a one-way data flow. And so the cool thing about a one-way data flow is it almost feels like a throwback back, you know, several years ago, because everyone's like two-way data binding now.
Right.
But the nice thing about a one-way data flow, it's almost like you're clicking F5 and refreshing the whole page, and then just all the information just trickles down and updates itself. So conceptually, in your head, when you solve a problem, you think of that. You don't have to worry that this updates this, which updates that, which updates this, because that gets crazy if you ever get into a bug.
Right.
Like, how do I replicate this?
Right.
So you treat it like the whole page is refreshing, but in reality, there's a virtual DOM, which you might have heard of,
uh-huh.
that it's an in-memory representation of what the DOM looks like. And so React could do some really smart things. For example, let's say you had a list of 10 items. You deleted two, but then you added two. Well, what React could do is like, well, essentially, you still have the same number of items that you had before. So instead of deleting two DOM nodes, creating two brand new nodes, and updating the text, it'll say, well, I'll just update the text that was already there. And that's a super quick action on the DOM.
And that's interesting because the first I have these things called brain exceptions whenever I hear something that doesn't sound right. But it is right in this case. It's like, wait a minute, but if you are if you are taking just replacing the names on those, how do you fire events back? And then I realized, but you don't, right? Because data only comes in.
Right.
Event stores get changed. The controller pushes it down again.
So that's the one way.
And so there's no need to listen to anything on that dump. So the other question is, how do you, like on a button, for example, handle that action? Like, where does that go?
So when you wire up your JSX or build up your JSX, if you want to add a listeners, you know, there's like a on click, which almost, again, that's a throwback years ago. You're like, don't do that. Well, JSX is really an abstraction on top of the DOM. Uh-huh. You're not actually, it might look like you have an H1, but it's really a component that is in React. Under the covers, all events are delegated to the document, much like you would in doing jQuery with the delegate method or the three-parameter version of on. And so it feels like you're kind of doing something dirty, but in the end, it's just delegating all the events bubble up to the document. That's where everything's registered, and then it wires up. And then inside of your component, you'll have like, you know, handle, click, and you would do something. And possibly you would trigger an action, which again goes to that flow of the flux.
I see. And so if there needs to be a data change, what happens? So you say, okay, this has been clicked. You say, okay, I need to change this in the data store. Then the data store gets that message. It goes to the controller and says, here's new data, do something.
Yeah. And so the controller is a controller React component. It's not this separate like controller JS file.
I see.
It's still kind of it's a React component that's controlling subcomponents that are more stupid.
I see. So you got to be really careful on how small you make these components, right? And how big. Is there like a trade-off? Is it good to have a lot of children? Is it not good for performance, or does it not matter?
What you want to do, and what I found that works best in our product, is have a lot of smaller components that they're, you know, it's really predictable what comes in and what comes out. And then just compose those together. It's okay if you have a lot of them. The data will just trickle down the tree. And if you ever do run into some performance problems, there's a nice suite of React tools in the command line or in the browser tools that you could actually say, where's all the time being processed? Was there a lot of time that React had to figure out something just for it to know that it didn't need to render anything? Mm-hmm. Those are the ones you want to look for. Did it spend a lot of time just to figure out it didn't need to do anything? And if that's the case, there's actually some hooks that you could tie into in the component yourself, and since you know you wrote the component, you know, oh, in this certain scenario, just punt. I know it will never render, and you can kind of give it suggestions to really help it tune
itself. Interesting. So you might even, with particular data, be able to dynamically say, you don't need me.
Yeah.
Nop.
Yeah.
Right.
And then it'll just pass over, and it won't even figure that out for you.
I see. That's interesting. So one of the things that you're known for, and it's moving to the next topic. When I think of code quality specifically for JavaScript, I think Elijah Manner. So what are some things that you use to help with code quality, or what are some suggestions that you have in JavaScript particularly?
Good question. That's changed over time. There's several tools that have been out for a long time. JS Lint is probably one of the earlier ones by Douglas Crockford. Mm-hmm. Great set of tools. It would essentially say, you know, hey, use semicolons. Use the triple equals, not the double, because you don't want type coercion. Some really nice things like that. There weren't a lot of configurations to say, maybe I don't care about this, or that's a little too harsh. And so the community kind of forked that and made JS Hint, and basically made a lot more options optional.
Sure.
But then they added a lot more features, like some cool ones that I like are like code complexity. Like that's cyclomatic complexity, which is a, you know, C-sharp that's old hat, but in JavaScript land, I'm like, oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, max length, number of lines, max depth. Like, you don't want a for loop with a while loop with an if, and it just gets crazy. But since then, another tool has come out called ESLint. It's created by Nicholas Zakis.
Okay.
He used to work at Yahoo with Crockford, but now he is working somewhere else. But the cool thing about that is it supports all the rules from all the two, JSLint and JSHint. But it has tons more cool rules because it uses an AST parser, abstract syntax tree. So it could actually take apart all of your logic, and you could actually make your own rules, which I really like that. And so what some community members have done is create like a whole suite of rules for React, for Angular, for Ember, for Backbone. Because there's certain
patterns.
There's certain patterns that are particular to those frameworks. And this will help enforce, like, oh, yeah, I need to structure it this way or that way. So I really like that fact. But it could actually do some really interesting things. So in JavaScript and ES5 and beyond, functions have a bind method where you could actually, you know, you could change what this context is or pass parameters. So when it's invoked later, it's creating a closure. When it's invoked later, it'll know all that information. One of the cool rules, I forget the name of it, but what it basically is, if you ever call bind, but then later when it's invoked, you never actually use the this implicit parameter, it'll actually tell you, like, there's no reason to bind it because you're never actually using the this.
Interesting. So
cool rules like that, which were really impossible or really hard to do in older languages or older linters, you could do now.
Interesting. And so now you can even, like, if you're making a new JavaScript framework and you want people to use it in a specific way for performance or for whatever reason, you can add something to ESLint.
Definitely.
And say, here's how you can lint this framework's code.
Yeah.
Now, how hard is it to use ESLint? Is it a package you bring? I write demoware, and so I've used Lint, JSLint, way just typing stuff in and it told me stuff. But how do you actually put that as part of your process when you're building these types of applications?
That's a great question. Like all the others, it's an NPM module. You could pull that in. It's also, when you install it, there's a command line interface, so you could use that. You could also plug in your IDE. So I use GitHub Atom currently, but you know, Sublime Text and a lot of other things, you could pull in ESLint. Something that we do, we actually use Webpack to actually bundle all our code together with you know, common JS modules and things like that. Initially, we had during its compilation process, because it's kind of, it watches the system and recompiles, so it's very quick. We used to have it lint our code while it's processing whatever we changed. But that was getting kind of slow, and we didn't want to affect our normal developer workflow.
Sure.
So we actually pulled that out, because I use it in my IDE, but we can't enforce that with everybody, because, you know, one guy on our team uses Sublime, another uses Vim. It's just, if they can, that's great. But what we did, we pulled it out of the actual compile process and made a pre-commit hook in Git. And so there's actually a cool NPM package called pre-commit. You just install it, and in your package.json file, you have a registry pre-commit, and then you give it an array of NPM scripts that you want to run before the Git actually occurs. And if it fails, then it says, sorry, here's all the errors. And usually there's like opt-out, like if you really need to commit and you can't fix them all, there's like a dash dash ignore or something like that. Try not to use that, but at least it enforces all of us to at least do one last linting. Not only do we lint our JavaScript, but we lint our SAS.
And there's SAS linting now too.
Yeah, so I'm big into that because SAS or less could get out of hand very quickly. Some of my favorite features of those are, one, you could enforce that anytime you set a color, that you're setting it to a variable.
Oh, interesting.
Instead of, you know, pound CCC.
Sure.
So it really enforces that you're trying to abstract your color scheme from the rest of your SAS. Another one that, if there are only three rules, it would be, there's tons more, but my three favorite are the color one, the preventing too nested, like if you nest your SAS or less too deeply, it looks great and it makes you almost feel like, oh, this is kind of...
I'm so smart.
This is programming, I'm nesting. But what the end result is a really highly specific score with CSS. Mm-hmm. And the more specific your score in CSS, it's really hard to override that. Like, that's where you start putting want to pound important and other crazy things that you don't want to do. It'll make your designers mad at you. Mm-hmm. So you can help enforce a certain level. By default, it's like three levels. But, you know, as much as possible, you want to pull that up.
Right.
And then my third favorite is just enforcing a naming standard. So anytime you create a class or a selector, you actually tell it to obey a certain naming convention. You could use regular expressions if you like that kind of thing, or there's some pre-baked ones.
And that's interesting because, I mean, for quality, when you're coming from a C# world, like, your compiler takes care of a lot of that sometimes.
Very true.
And then there's code analysis tools also to go on top of that. But you're saying now that you can do linting for both JavaScript, not just for checking semicolons and triple equals, but also checking if you're really working well in a particular framework. Mm-hmm. And then you can also go to Less or SAS and do that checking as well.
Yeah, exactly. And there's the Ruby version is SCSS-lint. That's in Ruby, but our app is purely, you know, JavaScript, Node, and then the back end is Java, so we just do a course call. And so we don't actually have the middle tier, so we don't use Ruby on this particular project. But recently now there's a SAS-lint, S-A-S-S, and it's Node-based. And so we're wanting to switch to that so we don't have any Ruby dependencies.
That's awesome. So next question, what are some of the talks you're giving here?
Well, when I was on React, it was a full room. Most of the people, I think, are doing Angular, and they were just interested in what is this React thing, and why are people talking about it? So I was really excited about it. I think it went well. Tomorrow, I'm doing two talks, one on JavaScript code smells. It kind of goes into linting. I don't talk too much about rules that already exist, just because they've been around for a long time.
Sure.
I focus more on, these are things that I still think are smelly, but there are no rules to check. Mm. And so what I did is I tried to make rules for those things. Like one of them is a switch statement. I'm pretty hardcore against the switch statement because typically it smells of, I need to refactor this. And usually it's the strategy pattern. One of the reasons I think it smells so much is because there's so many concerns right all together. And typically when you start a switch statement, it's kind of one-liners, but it's so easy and tempting to go in and like, oh, I need to add another line here, another line here. And then what happens, if you think about the solid principles, if you want to change something, you shouldn't actually be changing the thing that you actually wrote.
Yeah.
Because it could break. And so by pulling out with a strategy pattern, you could actually move out the functionality. And if you add a new feature, just plug it into like a system and have it work. And
sure.
You're not accidentally breaking something you didn't need to break. So that's one talk. There's lots of other smells I talk about. And then one is CSS for developers. The more and more I talk at conferences, I'm seeing a certain types of personas that are coming out. The one I call Backend Brian, really good developer, knows what he's doing. You know, maybe he's a C# expert or Java expert. But then they're kind of being thrown into the front end, if they like it or not. And what happens is JavaScript wants to get past the dynamic nature of it and it's functional, because that's maybe a new term for people who aren't used to that. Then they can kind of get it.
Sure.
And markup, it's just markup, it's tags. But when it comes to CSS, you know, when you first look at a tutorial or read an article, it seems simple. But then when you try to do something a designer tells you, it's like you're pulling your hair out and you're like, I can't do this. This is insane. This doesn't make any sense. And it's a totally different beast. And so I've seen that type of persona back in Brian. And so I was like, that used to be me. Because even though I'm a front-end developer, I've always had like some guy who's really good at designing and doing CSS. So he's always done it for me. And then a recent job I got, I was expected to do the whole front-end stuff, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, oh my goodness, I had this huge open wound that I need to fill. And so I just spent, you know, a lot of time just calling my friends at night and like, how do I even get my head around this? And
sure.
So I wanted to make a talk for that type of person, because that was me. And then I go even deeper, like, okay, now how do we organize our, because it's code. Like, a lot of people don't think of it, but you could organize it and treat it like code so that when you come back, you're not just making a mess of everything.
And nowadays, especially with Less and SAS, it's becoming more and more code.
Exactly, and that's kind of how I moved quickly into SAS, how to organize it. A lot of the same principles apply to Less. And then I have two other personas. One's just Junior Jacob. He just came out of college or watched a bunch of Pluralsight courses.
Sure.
Doesn't have real world experience yet. And then one, I try to tease like more advanced topics in there. And I call mid-level Melissa, who she's good at what she does. She can get the job done, but she can't stay on the latest and greatest.
Mm-hmm. Like,
it's just hard to keep up.
Sure.
And so I have a lot of like best practices or, you know, what's the coolest thing to do these days that works across browsers and things like that.
Let's switch gears now and talk a little bit about running tasks. Because obviously if you're using Less and SAS and maybe even TypeScript, you're going to need these middle task steps in order to get it down into something that's usable. What is your sense on grunt versus gulp versus something else?
Good question. For many years, I was big into grunt. I actually had a talk here a couple years ago on grunt. I was super excited about it, and it's great. Gulp was just coming out at the time, and I was like, you know, I need to kind of switch over because I really did like it because I love JavaScript.
Sure.
And you pretty much just write JavaScript. But then recently, we switched to something called Webpack, and that's what, again, we used Browserify. It's a way to bring in common JS modules and allow you to use it on the web.
Yeah.
We switched to Webpack for a couple reasons. I'm going to answer your question, but there's a little history. So one of the cool things Webpack allows you to do that Browserify didn't do well, and I think near the end it did, is we didn't want one huge JavaScript component for our app, our single page app. We thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could have two? One's things that we didn't write, like React itself, mm-hmm. some internationalization components, some parts of Lodash that we didn't write, just things like that. Our Flux framework that we use, because those rarely change. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be great if we could push that to the user, stamp it with some kind of a unique GUID, and then later if we release another version, that never changed, so the user will actually still get to use the same version sure. they did before. And then have another one of the things that we wrote, because it changes more frequently.
Yeah.
And so Webpack lets you do that really easily. Some of it's actually kind of super magic. What you could do is you could give it a threshold. Like, first you could say, here's my vendors. But then if you want to split out even further, you could say, if there is any modules that are used less than three times, like, you know, components, then split that out into its own, or if it's used more than three times, split that out into a common one.
I see.
But if it's used less than, just keep it in the bowl. Because you can do some really dynamic things. And then we started using Karma. So both of those are very rich for our testing and for mm-hmm. our development workflow. And so we found, like, well, we don't actually need to use Grunt or Gulp. We could just use the NPM scripts. So inside your package JSON, mm-hmm. you could actually have a scripts. And then you get certain entries, and then you just, as long as you know the CLI, the command line interface for those, you just
put them in.
Hey, lint, use ESLint, say dash dash cache, and I want to look at the JS and JX files in this folder, and so then I could say npm run lint, and it will go in there, figure out what needs to do. The cool thing about these rules is each of those scripts. If it sees a pre-lint and a post-lint, if I say npm run lint, it'll first run the pre, do the normal one, and then do a post. So possibly if you want to run your tests, npm test, maybe you have a pre-test that will lint it before it actually tests it. So you can do some cool things like that. But we found that's all we need for our stuff. One runs like a dev server
uh-huh.
that does the continuous recompilation. One does like just a build. One does a build to production.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have test. We have a test watch. And then we have a lint. And then, again, the pre-commit hook, we run several of those. We always lint our code before we commit any of our code. So it's a really nice workflow. And like we don't have all these extra files. And all. It's just really easy. It's like, here's our dependencies.
So you're saying that, I mean, obviously, if you want to do some super custom stuff, you can go to Grunt or Gulp.
Right.
But if you're just starting, you might not even need it. Just use the scripts right inside of the, was it package.config or package.json?
And I think that's a great place to start. If you find yourself getting a little too gnarly, you have some really crazy use cases, sure, go ahead and use one of those other tools. But it just challenged us to think, this is not as complex as we think. And a lot of these tools like Karma, they have watchers baked in already.
Right.
So you don't necessarily need Gulp or Grunt to do those watches for you. Like the tools these days are smarter. Just leverage what they already do instead of have another tool to repeat what they're doing already.
Awesome.
So yeah, it's really nice.
So where can folks go to find out more about some of the stuff we've talked about? Just if they want to follow up.
Yeah, so on my blog, the three talks that I did here, all my slides are online and have pretty much resources for all the things we talked about in my slides. Not all of them have been recorded yet. Mm-hmm. I hope to get that remedied soon.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm pretty loud, so follow me, Elijah Manor. I'm always interested in what's latest in our tech world, right. Especially in the front end. That's kind of where I live.
Sure.
So I'm always looking, figuring out the best things, the new ways. I try not to be too shiny thing. Like I try to vet the things pretty well.
Sure.
Like this is solid. Like, I don't want to steer people the wrong way.
Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, bud.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
So how do you like Dev Connection? You've been here before?
Yes.
Well, Dev Intersection, sorry.
I've been to every angle bracket so far, so it just keeps getting better.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us. Thanks for watching. We're here in Las Vegas for Dev Intersection, and we will see you next time. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.